Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be here. I don't think I have ever been called an Aryan Jew. It's the first time for everything, I suppose. I'd like to begin the remarks today with two brief stories. A couple of years ago, I was speaking with my then 10-year-old son about how now, since he was getting older at the age of 10, decisions he was making in his life were going to start actually counting. And so they were going to begin to mark out a path that his life would one day take. So maybe now, at the age of 10, he should start thinking about what the path would one day be that his decisions now were going to indicate. As Aristotle said, after all, it makes no small difference whether we form habits of one kind or another from our very youth. It makes a very great difference, indeed, all the difference. And to drive the point home of this sage fatherly lecture, I asked my son to consider what he would do if, much later in life, he realized that his life had indeed gone down a path he didn't want. Now, without missing a beat, my son said, "I'd hit the reset button." Ah, yes, the reset button. It came as something of a shock to him, I think, as he began to realize the consequences of the fact that life, unlike video games, does not have a reset button. Here's the second story. This past summer, I taught a course on the ethics of philanthropy for the Fund for American Studies. The course had students from all over the country, from South America, from Europe, from the Far East. One of the essays I had the students read for the course was William Graham Sumner's canonical The Forgotten Man. If you haven't read it recently, Sumner argues that politics often proceeds in the following way. Activist A sees someone in a bad way, B. So he calls his friend the politician C, and A and C soon figure out a way to make citizen D pay for some new program to help B. Sumner points out that this citizen D, the forgotten man, is the person who does everything right. He stays sober. He stays upright. He doesn't ask others to pay his way. He works productively. He honors his obligations, his responsibilities. Yet despite his virtue, indeed, this is Sumner's argument, because of his virtue, he's punished by the activist and the politician. For he's made to provide not only for himself and his own family and his own obligations, but also for whoever and whatever the activist and the politician think deserves his money. Now, Sumner's argument is not that all recipients of aid are undeserving. Clearly, some of them are deserving. But he argues that the unheard-from forgotten man, as he calls him, is also deserving of our concern. Shouldn't we celebrate this person, Sumner asks, rather than punishing him? Shouldn't we have as much concern for his well-being as we have for the people to whom we're giving his money? Indeed, shouldn't one of our societal goals be to convert as many people as possible into these forgotten men? Now, this strikes me as an important and plausible argument, whether we end up agreeing with Sumner or not. But what was my student's reaction to this argument? Well, it was clear and resounding. Here it is. It's his own fault that the forgotten man is forgotten. He needs to get politically active and make his voice heard. Now, just consider that response for a minute. He should get political? I gently suggested that if all the forgotten men in the country decided to become politically active whenever their interests were threatened, it might lead to a few problems. For example, who might fix the cars or build the houses or run the farms or man the stores? Doesn't somebody need to be engaged in productive labor, if for no other reason than to give all the activists and politicians something to redistribute according to their wisdom? But many of the students would just have none of it. Everybody, they thought, had to be politically active. Indeed, some of the students thought that everybody needed to be a political activist. I suppose all the planes, trains, and automobiles, and not to mention the iPods and laptops, would just produce themselves in a circumstance like that. So I relate those two stories because I think they're indicative of what I'd like to suggest is a common and spreading malady. Many Americans today live in a world of unreality. It's a virtual world that bears only slight connection to the real one. Their world is a grandiose connection, creation that would be dashed to pieces in a second by the real world if it were not, I'd like to suggest, for the enormous wealth we enjoy. I think this is a deep and fundamental problem we face today as we proceed apace to destroy the institutions that have allowed the creation of the wealthiest and most prosperous nation on earth. Our spectacular wealth has enabled hundreds of millions of us to rise out of the miseries of poverty, but it has also enabled more and more of us to indulge not only bad judgment, but fantastical worldviews, because we, or someone at least, can always afford to pay someone else to clean up the messes when things go wrong. Like many other things, wealth is a blessing, but it can also become a curse in excess. There's no denying the astonishing transformation in the standard of living that the commercial revolution has provided for those lucky enough to be a part of it. Just one fact will illustrate the transformation. The worldwide life expectancy in 1800 was in the low 30s. Today it's 67. In 1800, an American male could expect to live to about the age of 45. His life expectancy at birth today is 75, a 65% increase. Now, this astonishing increase in wealth has enabled us to do many beneficial things, including, as I say, dramatically extending people's lives. But let me dwell for just a second on one not-so-good thing it does. It allows us to insulate ourselves from the consequences of bad decisions. It's like the magical ring in Plato's story of Gyges. What does the shepherd boy, you'll recall this story, don't you? What does the shepherd boy do when he finds the ring? Well, of course, he seduces the queen, gets an audience with the king, kills him, and puts himself on the throne. Now I realize all of us would do the same in a similar situation and twice on Sundays. Now, as you also know, probably Socrates goes on to argue that it's never in anyone's interests properly regarded to act unjustly. As students will often say, right, tell that to Bill Clinton. But the moral of the Ring of Gyges story is that when people do not have a fear of the consequences from doing bad things, they, or at least some of them, will do bad things. Socrates' response notwithstanding, the truth that story illustrates is that people respond to the incentives they face and they respond to the feedback they receive. So I want to give you a couple of examples of this. It turns out that the wearing of bicycle helmets does not decrease the chances of your getting into a significant injury while cycling. Why not? Well, because feeling invulnerable under a helmet, people take greater risks. And the cars, the trucks, and the buses around them do the same. It also turns out that the increase in proportion of people wearing helmets while skiing or snowboarding has not led to a proportionate decrease in significant injuries. Again, why not? Well, because people feel invincible wearing their helmets and they ski way beyond their abilities, taking risks that they otherwise wouldn't consider taking. One more example, a little more controversial, but I think there's very good evidence for it, and that's seat belts. Talk about something you're not allowed to utter in polite company. It turns out, astonishingly, that there is no evidence that lives have been saved from the worldwide large increase in the wearing of seatbelts. Why not? It's for the same reason. People wearing seatbelts feel invulnerable, and they take at the margins greater risks than they otherwise would, which tend to cancel out the benefits of wearing seatbelts. After the 1983 law was passed in Britain, mandating seatbelt wearing for all drivers, certain deaths actually increased, namely deaths of pedestrians and bicyclists. Because the drivers, now feeling more invulnerable, just sped a lot more. Now, the reason for this phenomenon is called homeostasis, or risk compensation. The more that people perceive that risks are minimized, and by the way, people often wildly misestimate risks in life, the more they're likely they are to engage in dangerous or foolish behavior. So, undertaking to protect people from the unpleasant consequences of bad decisions, which is what safety measures like helmets and seatbelts largely do, turns out to give them exactly the mental ammunition they need to, you guessed it, keep making bad decisions. The more you believe the cost to you of dangerous risks have been lessened, the more risks you take. Now, I'd like to apply this lesson to a recent case, Bernie Madoff. His malfeasance looms large in our consciousness, and mine especially, since he was on the board of trustees at the institution where I teach, the university, Yeshiva University. Now, of course, no one wants what he did to happen again. But let me ask you, what would be the best way to ensure that there will be lots more Bernie Madoffs in the future? Well, here's the answer. by telling people not to exercise scrutiny and skeptical judgment when investing their money because there's some government agency, or maybe lots of government agencies, who will watch out for them. That, ladies and gentlemen, I suggest, is precisely the wrong thing to do. Contrast it with this. Suppose you said to people, "You are on your own. If you invest foolishly and lose your money, too bad for you. Don't come crying to us, so you better invest wisely." Well, now if we said that to people, what do you think would happen? Well, there'd be wailing and gnashing of teeth, I suppose, and crying out, "Who will protect us?" But not too long, I'd wager, people would begin asking their brokers difficult questions. They'd begin shopping their money around, bringing market pressures to bear, and in short, being far more careful with their money than they otherwise would be. That, I promise you, would be a much more effective and better system of regulatory oversight than anything we're likely to get out of Washington, D.C. Now, I suggest that many welfare and state aid programs, including, I should add, government bailouts, provide exactly in this way the wrong incentives by shielding people from the risks and real consequences of dangerous and foolish things they do. It encourages people to engage in all manner of risky behavior, try out all sorts of dangerous activities, flout the rules of morality and decorum, all with relative and increasing, I might add, impunity. Why shouldn't they? Indeed, shouldn't we expect more people to behave foolishly if we eliminate the costs to them? Let me give you a hypothetical scenario. Imagine you were given the authority to run a large corporation, but you were assured that you wouldn't be held responsible if the company went out of business. You were assured that you couldn't lose your job no matter what you did. Well, just think of all the zany things you might try. Maybe you'd decree that no one was allowed to make more than 3 times the lowest salary. Or maybe you'd decide that since everyone is equal, you would randomly swap people around in jobs. So one day janitor and the next day CEO. Maybe you decide that everyone should be able to take 3 months off per year without losing their job, without even a reduction in pay. Well, why not? In a fantasy world like that, you might try out all sorts of things and all sorts of magical ideas. What fun it would be. Now, if we suppose that our intrepid czar, let's call him, gets to run, again, guilt-free, a company that's already doing well and already has a built-up store of capital when he's put in charge, it might actually be able to survive for some time under this kind of daft, zany leadership. It might be able to lumber along as he increases vacations and benefits to workers, cuts pay to executives, adds green regulations, but forbids price increases, and so on. How long might a company like that coast until the added weight finally brings it to a halt? Who knows? I assume you see the analogy I'm drawing. Now, you might think I'm exaggerating, but let me ask you, really, how different is this from the situation we currently face as a nation? Which of our audaciously hopeful political leaders really has any idea how to run, well, anything? Which of them has ever had a job in the private, that is, the productive sector? Many of them have instead come out of academia, which may be the most corrosive environment ever conceived by man for understanding reality. The institutions that allow the creation of wealth can thus generate not only prosperity, but also an indifference to the nature of the institutions that allowed its creation. And the wealth created can give people the luxury of indulging that indifference because they do not have to exercise prudential judgment regarding scarce resources, proper allocation of time and energy, even how to regulate their behavior so that they can contribute to society rather than just free ride on it. Great wealth may pay for a lot of safety nets, and it may pay for a lot of bailouts when people do poorly. As Adam Smith said, there's a great deal of ruin in a nation. He was right, but even a great deal is not without limit. And what our wealth cannot do is make the costs of bad decisions go away. Foolish behavior will issue in costs somewhere to someone. That's the forgotten man of William Graham Sumner's essay. So here then is what I'm calling the curse of wealth. It enables the alleviation of suffering and poverty, but it also enables release from the rigors of reality that can train and hone individual judgment. We trade a robust independence, a common sense, and a healthy connection to reality for a comfortable but vapid and inane life in a virtual, that is, an unreal world. Well, okay. Well, suppose you all agree with me to this point. What can be done about it? I'm not suggesting that we should stop producing wealth. Far too much good and far too much benefit to human life comes from the production of increasing wealth. Instead, I think we have to take seriously the obligation to figure out what the best uses of wealth are. As Andrew Carnegie argued, this is indeed a moral obligation. Wealth is a powerful tool. It can be used for enormous good, but it can also be used in an enormously destructive fashion. According to Carnegie, the wealthy man must undertake the difficult but morally necessary task of close scrutiny and investigation to see what incentives his giving will create. Will giving money to this organization or to this person encourage good things? The good things that Carnegie spoke of were industry, perseverance, the development of independent judgment, or to use a quaint word, virtue? Or will it encourage bad things, laziness, dependence, enervation, what used to be called vice? This is often very difficult to judge, and it requires a great deal of detailed knowledge about the people involved, the situations they face, the resources and opportunities open to them, etc. That is what makes effective giving very difficult. And by the way, nearly impossible for a distant legislator to get right, but that's a different point. So one thing that our wealth, I believe, requires of us is to take seriously our obligation to use it effectively and wisely. This entails what Albert J. Nock called the philosopher's first obligation, which is to see things as they are and not as we would like for them to be. This is not as easy as it sounds, my friends. Indeed, it's surprising how much effort is required to allow ourselves to see things as they are. So inclined are we to let our hopes, our aspirations, and in a wealthy society like ours, our fantasies even, color what we see and to affect what we believe. To view the world as it in fact is, to view human beings and human nature as they are, requires a persistent struggle. And the effort is often met not with gratitude, but with condemnation from those who, among us, who prefer the hope and the fantasy to the reality. But serious times call for serious people. And here I think finally the responsibilities of those who are academics, like myself, are finally implicated. It is our obligation to see things as they are and to stop indulging the nonsense we see in the unreal world of education. Now, I don't wish to overstate the effect that any academic can actually have, but I would like to suggest that we can make a start by calling our students, our colleagues, our administrators on the fantastical delusions that they routinely engage in. And let us be honest, there is a lot of that in higher education. Whole fields of study float on clouds of unreality in American universities. They're supported by invisible skyhooks that are utterly disconnected from reality. And indeed, one might suggest that the entire system of higher education seems almost designed to encourage an unreality. Consider for a moment these quick facts about academics. First of all, we academics have something called tenure, and we work for institutions with endowments, both of which insulate us from the real world, very nicely, I might add. We enjoy something called faculty governance, whereby people who've never run anything come to believe they can run everything. We develop a sense of superiority and condescension that comes from having little or no involvement with the outside world. And we nurse a kind of resentment because the outside world does not properly recognize our superiority. Well, this, ladies and gentlemen, is a witch's brew of dysfunction. And I'll tell you, I think it's amazing that anything good comes out of it. But certainly not surprising that a lot of nonsense does. So for those of us who are academics, I'd like to contend that we need to stop accommodating that nonsense. That takes some courage, but as we've seen earlier today, not as much courage as you might think. If not for yourself, then think for your students or your country or your civilization. John Stuart Mill argued that truth can arise only out of a crucible of contentious debate, contentious examination. Well, I exhort you, be the other side. Stand up and proclaim loudly for dissenting views. Make people defend not only their pieties, but the premises on which those pieties are based. And you may be surprised how effective this can be at stanching the flow of nonsense. Since proper diagnosis is the first step to treatment, I believe that understanding the connection between wealth and unreality is crucial. And this exhortation to act to academics especially is motivated by the fact that I think we are not playing tiddlywinks here. In fact, I'll say, and as I'm going to come to my conclusion, I think our civilization hangs in the balance at the moment. Future historians, I believe, will look to decisions made now as the causes that led to the ultimate fate of our civilization. You, therefore, have a dog in this race, ladies and gentlemen, as I do as well. And to repeat from what my son said, or what I said to my son, there are no reset buttons. So let me close on a serious note. Most of us have been lucky enough, I think, to live in a time of relative peace and prosperity. We've enjoyed a material comfort that has afforded us the luxury of not having to fight for or even really think hard about the institutions that are required to uphold civilization. But when the threats to civilization are gaining ground, I think we are required to rouse ourselves from our luxury and face reality with seriousness. I don't think the future is lost. On the contrary, I think not only that Western civilization can be saved, but it's worth considerable effort to do so. But I also believe that we can no longer afford to continue living in our, as I say, virtual world of unreality. Because despite our wealth, the real world is threatening to reassert itself with a vengeance. And it will not be deterred by the fact that it does not comport with our juvenile wishes about what the world ought to be. As I see it then, ladies and gentlemen, we have two choices. One is to assume that the battle for civilization is lost, and thus to hunker down and hope to ride out this coming storm of impoverishment and barbarism. The only other option, I believe, is to stand, to face reality with the seriousness that it warrants, and to shoulder our part of the real burden of upholding civilization, leaving the rest in God's hands. That's the course I choose, and I hope you will join me. Thank you.